Chapter 48. Paddy Clancy lived around the corner from me on Brooklyn Heights. He called to see if I'd like to go to the opening of a new bar in the village, the Lion's Head. Of course I'd like to go, and I stayed till the bar closed at 4 a.m. and missed work the next day. The bartender, Al Coblin, thought for a while I was one of the singing Clancy brothers and charged me nothing for the drinks till he discovered I was only Frank McCourt, a teacher. Now, even though I had to pay for my drinks, I didn't mind because the Lion's Head became my home away from home, a place where I could feel comfortable the way I never did in uptown bars. Reporters from the first office of the Village Voice drifted in from next door, and they attracted journalists from everywhere. The wall opposite the bar was soon adorned with the framed book jackets of writers who were regular customers. That was the wall I coveted, the wall that haunted me and had me dreaming that someday I'd look up at a framed book jacket of my own. Up and down the bar, writers, poets, journalists, playwrights talked about their work, their lives, their assignments, their travels. Men and women would have a drink while waiting for cars to planes that would take them to Vietnam, Belfast, Nicaragua. New books came out, Pete Hamill, Joe Flaherty, Joel Oppenheimer, Dennis Smith, and went up on the wall while I hung on the periphery of the accomplished, the ones who knew the magic of print. At the Lion's Head, you had to prove yourself in ink or be quiet. There was no place here for teachers, and I went on looking at the wall, envious. Mam moved into a small apartment across the street from Malachi on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Now she could see Malachi, his new wife Diana, their sons Connor and Cormac, my brother Alfie, his wife Lynn, and their daughter Allison. She could have visited all of us as often as she liked, and when I asked her why she didn't, she barked at me. I don't want to be beholden to anyone. It irritated me always when I called and asked her what she was doing, and she said, nothing. If I suggested that she get out of the house and visit a community center or a senior citizen center, she'd say, Allah, for the love of Jesus, will you leave me alone? Whenever Alberta invited her to dinner, she always made a point of being late, complaining of the long journey from her Manhattan apartment to our house in Brooklyn. I wanted to tell her she didn't have to come at all if it was such a bother to her, and the last thing she needed anyway was a dinner she was getting that fat. But I curbed my tongue so that there wouldn't be tension at the table. Unlike the first time she came to dinner and pushed the noodles aside, she now devoured everything put before her, though if you offered her a second helping, she'd look prim and say no thanks, as if she had the appetite of a butterfly, and then pick at the crumbs on the table. If I told her she didn't have to pick at crumbs, there was more food in the kitchen, she'd tell me leave her alone, that I was getting to be a right bloody torment. If I told her she'd be better off if she stayed in Ireland, she'd bristle. What do you mean I'd be better off? Well, you wouldn't be lying in bed half the day with the radio stuck to your ear listening to every half-witted show they have. I listen to Malachi on the radio, and what's wrong with that? You listen to everything. You do nothing. Her face would grow pale, her nose pointed. She'd pick at invisible crumbs, and there might be a hint of watery eyes. Then I'd be pricked with guilt and invite her to stay for the night so that she wouldn't have to take that long subway ride to Manhattan. No, thank you. I'd rather be in my own bed if you don't mind. Oh, I suppose you're afraid of the sheets. All those diseases from foreigners in the laundromat. And she'd say, I think now 'tis the drink talking. Where's my coat? Alberta would try to soften the moment with another invitation to stay, that we had new sheets, and Mam needn't be nervous. 'Tisn't the sheets at all. I just want to go home. And when she saw me put on my coat, she'd say, I don't need anyone to walk me to the subway. I can find my own way. You're not going to walk these streets by yourself. I walk the streets by myself all the time. It was a long, silent walk up Court Street to the subway at Borough Hall. I wanted to say something to her. I wanted to get past my irritation and my anger and ask her that simple question, "How are you, ma'am?" I couldn't. When we reached the station, she said I didn't have to pay a fare to get through the turnstiles. She'd be all right on the platform. There were people there, and she'd be safe. She was used to it. I went in with her, thinking we might say something to each other. But when the train arrived, I let her go without even an attempt at a kiss, and watched her stumble towards the seat as the train pulled from the station. Down near Court Street and Atlantic Avenue, I remembered something she had told me months ago while we sat waiting for Thanksgiving dinner. "Isn't it remarkable," she said, "the way things turn out in people's lives?" "What do you mean?" "Well, I was sitting in my apartment, and I was feeling lonesome, so I went up and sat on one of the benches they have in the grassy island in the middle of Broadway. And this woman came along, a shopping bag woman, one of the homeless ones, all tattered and greasy, rooting around in the garbage can till she found a newspaper and sat beside me reading it, till she asked me if she could borrow my glasses because she could only read the headlines with the sight she had. And when she talked, I noticed she had an Irish accent, so I asked her where she came from, and she told me Donegal a long time ago. And wasn't it lovely to be sitting on a bench in the middle of Broadway with people noticing things and asking you where you came from? She asked if I could spare a few pennies for soup, and I said instead she could come with me to the Associated supermarket and we'd get some groceries and have a proper meal. Oh, she couldn't do that, she said, but I told her that's what I was going to do anyway. She wouldn't come inside the store. She said they wouldn't want the likes of her. I got bread and butter and rashers and eggs, and when we got home, I told her she could go in and have a nice shower, and she was delighted with herself, though there wasn't that much I could do about her clothes or the bag she carried. We had our dinner and watched television till she started falling asleep on me, and I told her to lie down there on the bed, but she wouldn't. God knows the bed is big enough for four people, but she lay down on the floor with a shopping bag under her head, and when I woke up in the morning, she was gone, and I missed her. I know it wasn't the dinner wine that had me against the wall in a fit of remorse. It was the thought of my mother being so lonesome she had to sit on a street bench, so lonesome she missed the company of a homeless shopping bag woman. Even in the bad days in Limerick, she always had an open hand and an open door. And why couldn't I be like that to her? Chapter 49. Teaching 9 hours a week at New York Technical College in Brooklyn was easier than 25 hours a week at McKee Vocational and Technical High School. Classes were smaller, students older, and there were none of the problems a high school teacher has to deal with, the lavatory pass, the moaning over assignments, the massive paperwork created by bureaucrats who have nothing to do but create new forms. I could supplement my reduced salary by teaching at Washington Irving Evening High School or substituting at Seward Park High School and Stuyvesant High School. The chairman of the English department at New York Technical College asked me if I'd like to teach a class of paraprofessionals. I said yes, though I had no notion of what a paraprofessional was. That first class, I found out. Here were 36 women, African-American, with a sprinkling of Hispanics, ranging in age from early 20s to late 50s, teacher aides in elementary schools and in college now with government help. They'd get 2-year associate degrees and perhaps continue their education so that someday they might become fully qualified teachers. That night, there was little time for teaching. After I'd asked the women to write a short autobiographical essay for the next class, they gathered up their books and filed out, apprehensive, still unsure of themselves, of each other, of me. I had the whitest skin in the room. When we met again, the mood was the same, except for one woman who sat with her head on the desk, sobbing. I asked what was the matter. She raised her head, tears on her cheeks. "I lost my books." "Oh, well," I said, "you'll get another set of books. Just go to the English department and tell them what happened." "You mean I won't get thrown out of college?" No, you won't be thrown out of college. I felt like patting her head, but I didn't know how to pat the head of a middle-aged woman who has lost her books. She smiled. We all smiled. Now we could begin. I asked for their compositions and told them I'd read some aloud, though I wouldn't use their real names. The essays were stiff, self-conscious. As I read, I wrote some of the more common misspelled words on the chalkboard, suggested changes in structure, pointed out grammatical errors. It was all dry and tedious, till I suggested the ladies write simply and clearly. For their next assignment, they could write on anything they liked. They looked surprised. Anything? But we don't have anything to write about. We don't have no adventures. They had nothing to write about. Nothing but the tensions of their lives, summer riots erupting around them, assassinations, husbands who so often disappeared, children destroyed by drugs, their own daily grind of housework, jobs, school, raising children. They loved the strange ways of words. During a discussion on juvenile delinquency, Mrs. Williams sang out, "No kid of mine gonna be no ute." "Ute?" "Yeah, you know, ute." She held up a newspaper where the headline howled, "Youth slays mom." "Oh," I said, and Mrs. Williams went on, "These utes, you know, running around slaying people, killing them too. Any kid of mine come home acting like a ute, and out he go on his you-know-what." The youngest woman in the class, Nicole, turned the tables on me. She sat in the back in a corner and never spoke till I asked the class if they'd like to write about their mothers. Then she raised her hand. "How about your mother, Mr. McCourt?" Questions came like bullets. "Is she still alive? How many children did she have? Where's your father? Did she have all those children with one man? Where's she living? Who's she living with? She living alone? Your mother's living alone. She has 4 sons. How come?" They frowned. They disapproved. Poor lady with 4 sons shouldn't be living alone. People should take care of their mothers, but what do men know? You can never tell a man what it's like to be a mother. And if it wasn't for the mothers, America would fall apart. In April, Martin Luther King was killed, and classes were suspended for a week. When we met again, I wanted to beg forgiveness for my race. Instead, I asked for the essays I'd already assigned. Mrs. Williams was indignant. "Look, Mr. McCourt, when they trying to burn your house down, you ain't sitting around writing no compositions." In June, Bobby Kennedy was killed. My 36 ladies wondered what was happening to the world. But they agreed you have to carry on, that education was the only road to sanity. When they talked about their children, their faces brightened, and I became irrelevant to their talk. I sat on my desk while they told each other that now they were in college themselves, they stood over their kids to make sure the homework was done. On the last night of classes in June, there was a final examination. I watched those dark heads bent over papers, the mothers of 212 children, and I knew that no matter what they wrote or didn't write on those papers, no one would fail. They finished. The last paper had been handed in, but no one was leaving. I asked if they had another class here. Mrs. Williams stood and coughed.
Mr. McCourt, we must say, it was a wonderful thing to come to college and learn so much about English and everything, and we got you this little something, hoping you like it and all."
She sat down sobbing, and I thought, this class begins and ends in tears. The gift was passed up, a bottle of shaving lotion in a fancy red and black box. When I sniffed it, I was nearly knocked over. But I sniffed again with gusto and told the ladies I'd keep the bottle forever in memory of them, this class, their youths. Instead of going home after that class,
I took the subway to West 96th Street in Manhattan and called my mother from a street telephone. "Would you like to have a snack?" "I don't know. Where are you?" "I'm a few blocks away." "Why?" "I just happen to be in the neighborhood."
"Visiting Maliki?"
"No, visiting you."
"Me? Why should you be visiting me?"
"For Christ's sake, you're my mother, and all I wanted to do was invite you all for a snack. What would you like to eat?" She sounded doubtful.
"Well, I love them jumbo shrimps they have in the Chinese restaurants."
"All right, we'll have jumbo shrimps."
"But I don't know if I'm able for them this minute. I think I'd prefer to go to the Greeks for a salad."
"All right, I'll see you there." She came into the restaurant, gasping for breath. And when I kissed her cheek, I could taste the salt of her sweat. She said she'd have to sit a minute before she could even think of food. That if she hadn't given up the cigarettes, she'd be dead now. She ordered the feta salad. And when I asked her if she liked it, she said she loved it. She could live on it.
"Do you like that cheese?"
"What cheese?"
"The goat cheese."
"What goat cheese?"
"The white stuff, the feta, that's goat cheese."
"'Tis not."
"'Tis." "Well, if I knew that was goat cheese, I'd never touch it. Because I was attacked by a goat once out the country in Limerick, and I'd never eat a thing that attacked me." "It's a good thing," I told her, "you were never attacked by a jumbo shrimp."
Chapter 50. In 1971, my daughter Maggie was born at Unity Hospital in the Bedford-Stuyvesant area of Brooklyn. There would be no problem taking home the right infant, since she seemed to be the only white one in the nursery. Alberta wanted a natural Lamaze childbirth, but the doctors and nurses at Unity Hospital had no patience with middle-class women and their peculiarities. They had no time for this woman and her breathing exercises and jabbed her with an anesthetic to hasten the birth. Instead, that slowed the rhythm so much, the impatient doctor clamped forceps on Maggie's head and yanked her from her mother's womb, and I wanted to punch him for the flatness he left on her temples. The nurse took the child to a corner to clean her and wash her, and when she finished, beckoned that I might now see my daughter with her red, astonished face and her black feet. The soles of her feet were black. "God, what kind of a birthmark have you inflicted on my child?" I couldn't say anything to the nurse, because she was black and might be offended that I didn't find my daughter's black feet attractive. I had a vision of my child as a young woman, lolling on a beach, lovely in a bathing suit, but forced to wear socks to conceal her disfigurement. The nurse asked if the baby was to be breastfed. No. Alberta had said she wouldn't have the time when she went back to work, and the doctor did something to dry up her milk. They wanted to know the child's name, and even though Alberta had toyed with Michaela, she was still under anesthetic and powerless, and I told the nurse, Margaret Ann, for my two grandmothers, and my sister who died at 21 days in this very borough of Brooklyn. Alberta was wheeled back to her room, and I called Maliki to tell him the good news, that a child had been born, but that she was afflicted with black feet. He laughed in my ear and told me I was an ass, that the nurse probably took footprints instead of fingerprints. He said he'd meet me at the Lion's Head, where everyone bought me a drink and I got stocious drunk. So drunk, Maliki had to hoist me home in a taxi, which made me so sick I threw up the length of Broadway, with the driver yelling that would cost me $25 for the cleaning of the cab, an unreasonable demand that deprived him of a tip and had him threatening to call the cops. "And what are you going to tell them?" said Maliki. "Are you going to tell them that you're a zigzag driver going from one side of Broadway to the other and making everyone sick? Is that what you're going to tell them?" And the driver was so angry he wanted to step out and confront Maliki, but changed his mind when my brother, holding me up, stood large and red-bearded on the sidewalk and asked the driver politely if he had any more comments before he went to meet his maker. The driver uttered obscenities about us and the Irish in general,
and drove through a red light, his left arm out the window, middle finger rigid in the air. Maliki brought me aspirins and vitamins and told me I'd be right as rain in the morning, and I wonder what that meant, right as rain, though that question was pushed from my head by the image of Maggie and the forceps flatness of her temples, and I was ready to jump from the bed to hunt down that damned doctor who wouldn't let my daughter be born in her own good time. But my legs wouldn't oblige me, and I fell asleep. Maliki was right. There was no hangover, only delight that a little child in Brooklyn had my name, and I'd have a lifetime watching her grow. And when I called Alberta, I could hardly talk with the tears in my throat, and she laughed and quoted my mother, "Your bladder is near your eye." That same year, Alberta and I bought the brownstone house where we'd been tenants on the parlor floor. We were able to buy it only because our friends Bobby and Marianne Barron lent us money and because Virgil Frank had died and left us $8,000. When we lived at 30 Clinton Street on Brooklyn Heights, Virgil was two floors below us. He was over 70, had a full head of comb-back white hair, a strong nose, his own teeth, and hardly a scrap of flesh on his bones. I visited him regularly because an hour with him was better than movies, television, and most books. His apartment was one narrow room with a kitchenette and a bathroom. His bed was a cot against the wall, and beyond that, a desk and a window with an air conditioner. Opposite the bed was a bookcase filled with volumes on flowers, trees, and birds, which he said he'd get around to someday as soon as he bought a pair of binoculars. "You'll have to be careful about buying binoculars, because you go into a store, and how are you going to test them? Salesmen in the store say, 'Oh, they're okay, they're strong, and how can you tell?' They won't let you take them outside to look up and down Fulton Street in case you make a run for it with the binoculars, and that's dumb. How the hell are you going to make a run for it when you're 70? In the meantime, he'd like to be able to see birds out his window. But all you can see from this apartment is pigeons fornicating on top of his air conditioner, and that pisses him off. He watches them. Oh, yeah, he watches them. Bangs on the window with the fly swatter. Tells them, "Get out of here, goddamn pigeons. Go fornicate in someone else's air conditioner." He tells me they're just rats with wings. All they do is eat and fornicate. And when they're finished with fornicating, they drop a load in the air conditioner. One load after another. Like that crap the birds, damn. I'm talking Brooklyn again, and that ain't good when you're selling water coolers. Like that bird crap in South America where the mountains are covered with it. What is it? Guana, yeah. Which is good for growing things, but not for air conditioners. Besides the books on outdoor life, he had a 3-volume set of the Summa Theologica of St. Thomas Aquinas. And when I opened the volume, he said, "I didn't know you liked that stuff. Wouldn't you prefer the birds?" I told him you can always get bird books, but his Summa was rare. And he said I could have it, except I'd have to wait till he died. "But don't worry, Frank, I'll put it in my will." He also promised to leave me his collection of ties, which dazzled me whenever he opened his closet door. The loudest, most colorful ties I'd ever seen. "You like them, eh? Some of these ties go all the way back to the 20s. On down to the 30s, 40s. Men knew how to dress then. They didn't go around tippy-toe like the man in the gray flannel suit afraid of a little collar. I always said never stint on the tie and the hat, because you have to look good when you're selling water coolers, which I did for 45 years. I'd go into an office and I'd say, 'What? What? You're telling me you're still drinking tap water from these old cups and glasses? Don't you know the danger to your health?' And Virgil would stand between bed and bookcase, rocking like a preacher, and delivering his sales spiel on water coolers. 'Yes, sir. I sell water coolers, and I want to tell you there's 5 things you can do with water. You can clean it, you can pollute it, you can heat it, you can cool it, and ha-ha, you can sell it. You know, and I don't have to tell you, Mr. Office Manager, you can drink it and you can swim in it, though there isn't much call for swimming water in the average American office. I want to tell you, my company has made a study of offices that drink our water and offices that don't drink our water. And you're right, Mr. Office Manager. The people who drink our water are healthier and more productive. Our water drives away the flu and improves digestion. We're not saying, Mr. Office Manager, that our water is solely responsible for the great productivity and prosperity of America, but we are saying that our studies show offices without our water are barely hanging on, desperate and wondering why. A copy of our study is available when you sign our yearly contract. At no extra charge, we'll survey your staff and give you an estimate of water consumption. I'm happy to observe you don't have air conditioning, because that means you'll need extra drinking water for your fine staff. And we know, Mr. Office Manager, that all water coolers bring people together. Problems are settled over a paper cup of water. Eyes meet, romances flourish, everybody happy, everybody eager to come to work every day. Increase productivity. We get no complaints. Sign right here. A copy for you, a copy for me, and we're in business. A knock on the door interrupted him. Who is it? A faint, old voice.
Virgil, it's Harry.
Can't talk to you now, Harry. I got the doctor here, and I'm naked, getting examined.
All right, Virgil. I'll come back later.
Tomorrow, Harry, tomorrow.
Okay, Virgil.
He told me that was Harry Ball, 85 years old. So old you can't hear his voice over a clothesline. Who drives Virgil crazy with his parking problems. He's got this big car, a Hudson, that they don't make no more. Is that right, no more or any more? You're an English teacher, I don't know. Never went beyond the 7th grade. Ran away from the Sisters of St. Joseph Orphanage, even if I'm leaving them money in my will. Anyway, Harry's got this car, and he goes nowhere with it. Says someday he's going to drive it to Florida to see his sister. But he's going nowhere because that car is so old, it wouldn't make it across the Brooklyn Bridge, and that goddamn Hudson is his life. He moves it from one side of the street to the other, back and forth, back and forth. Sometimes he brings the little aluminum beach chair and sits near his car, looking for a parking spot to open for next day. Or he walks around the neighborhood, looking for a spot. And if he finds one, he gets excited and gives himself a heart attack, rushing to his car to drive it to the new spot, which is now gone. And so is the one he was in. And there he is, driving around with no spot, cursing the government. I was with him once, and he nearly ran down a rabbi and two old women, and I said, "Christ, Harry, let me out." And he wouldn't, but I jumped out of the first red light, and he yelled after me. I was the type that flashed lights so the Japs could find Pearl Harbor, till I told him he was a dumb bastard that didn't know Pearl Harbor was bombed in broad daylight. And he sat there contradicting me with the light turning green and people honking and yelling, "Who gives a shit about Pearl Harbor, buddy? Move your goddamn Hudson." He could park that car in a garage for $85 a month, but that's more than he pays for rent, and that'll be the day Harry Ball ever wastes a penny. I'm frugal myself, I admit that, but he could make Scrooge look like a spendthrift. Is that the right word, spendthrift? I ran away from the orphanage in 7th grade. He asked me to go with him to a hardware store on Court Street so that he could get an egg timer for the telephone just installed.
An egg timer?
Yeah. This is a kind of hourglass with sand that runs for 3 minutes. And that's the way I like my egg. And when I use the telephone, I'll know when the 3 minutes is up, because that's how they charge you at the phone company, the bastards. I'll have the egg timer on my desk, and I'll hang up at the last grain of sand. On Court Street, I asked him if he'd like a beer and a sandwich at the Blarney Rose. He never went to bars and was shocked at the prices of beer and whiskey. 90 cents for a little shot of whiskey? Never. I went with him to a liquor store where he ordered cases of Irish whiskey and told the salesman his friend Frank liked it, and cases of wine vodka and bourbon, because he liked it himself. He told the man he wouldn't pay the lousy taxes on his purchase. "I'm giving you a big order here, and you want me to support the goddamn government on top of it? No, sir, pay for it yourself." The man agreed and said he'd deliver the 25 cases. Virgil called me next day. Even though his voice was weak, he told me, "I got the egg timer going here, so I have to talk fast. Can you come down? I need a little help. The door is open." He was sitting in his armchair, in his bathrobe. "I didn't get a wink of sleep last night. Couldn't get into the bed." He couldn't get into the bed because the liquor store man had piled up the 25 cases around his bed so high that Virgil couldn't climb over. He said he had to try some of the Irish whiskey and the wine, and that didn't help much when it was time to climb. He said he needed soup, something in his stomach to keep him from being sick. When I opened a can of soup and poured it into a pot with an equal amount of water, he asked if I'd read the instructions on the can. "No." "Well, how do you know what to do?" "It's common sense, Virgil." "Common sense, my ass." He was hangover, cranky. "Listen to me, Frank McCourt. You know why you'll never be a success?"
"Why?"
"You never follow the instructions on the package. That's why I have money in the bank and you don't have a pot to piss in. I always follow the instructions on the package."
Another knock on the door.
"What? What?" said Virgil.
"Virgil, it's me, Pete."
"Pete? Pete who? I can't see through the door."
"Pete Buglioso. Got something for you, Virgil."
"Don't talk Brooklyn to me, Pete. My name is Virgil, not Virgil. He was a poet, Pete. You should know, you're Italian."
"I don't know nothing about that, Virgil. I got something for you, Virgil."
"I don't want nothing, Pete. Call back next year."
"But, Virgil, you like what I have. Cost you a couple of bucks."
"What is it?"
"Can't tell you through the door, Virgil."
Virgil heaved himself from the armchair and stumbled to the egg timer on his desk. "All right, Pete, all right, you can come in for 3 minutes. I'm setting my egg timer."
He tells me open the door and tells Pete the egg timer is working, and even though grains of sand have already dropped, Pete still has 3 minutes, so start talking, Pete, start talking, and make it snappy.
"All right, Virgil, all right. But how the hell can I talk when you're talking? You talk more than anyone."
"You're wasting your time, Pete. You're hanging yourself. Look at the egg timer. Look at that sand. Sands of time, Pete. Sands of time."
"What are you doing with them boxes, Virgil? Rob a truck or something?"
"The egg timer, Pete. The egg timer."
"All right, Virgil. What I got here is, will you stop looking at the goddamn egg timer, Virgil, and listen to me? What I got here is prescription pads from a doctor's office on Clinton Street."
"Prescription pads? You've been robbing them doctors again, Pete?"
"I didn't rob him. I know a receptionist. She likes me."
"She must be deaf and dumb and blind. I don't need no prescription pads."
"Come on, Virgil, you never know. You might have a disease or a bad hangover and you'll need something."
"Bullshit, Pete. Your time is up. I'm busy."
"But Virgil..."
"Out, Pete, out. I have no control over that egg timer once it gets gone. And I don't want no prescription pads."
He pushed Pete out the door and yelled after him.
"You could get me in jail, and you're going to wind up in jail yourself selling stolen prescription pads."
He slumped back into his armchair and said he'd try the soup even though I hadn't followed the instructions on the can. He needed it to settle his stomach, but if he didn't like it, he'd have a little wine, and that would do the job. He tasted the soup and said, yeah, it was okay, and he'd have it and the wine too. When I popped the wine cork, he barked that I was not to pour the wine now, I was to let it breathe. Didn't I know that? And if I didn't, how could I teach school? He sipped his wine and remembered he had to call the air conditioning company about his problems with pigeons. I told him stay in his chair and handed him the telephone and the number of the company, but he wanted the egg timer too so that he could tell them they had 3 minutes to give him the information he needed.
"Hello? You listening to me?" I got the egg timer going, and you got 3 minutes to tell me how I can stop these goddamn pigeons. Excuse the language, miss. How I can stop these pigeons from making love on the outside part of my air conditioner. They're driving me crazy with the coo, coo, coo all day, and they shit all over the window. You can't tell me that now. You have to look it up. What do you have to look it up for? Pigeons fornicating in my air conditioner, and you have to look it up? Sorry, egg timer ran out, and that's the 3 minutes. Goodbye.
He handed me back the telephone.
And I'll tell you something else, he said. It's that goddamn Harry Ball that's responsible for all them pigeons shitting on my air conditioner. He sits in his goddamn aluminum beach chair when he's looking for a parking spot and feeds them pigeons over at Borough Hall. I told him once, cut it out, that they were just rats with wings. And he got so mad he wouldn't talk to me for weeks, and that suited me fine. These old guys feed pigeons because they don't have wives no more. Any more? I don't know. I ran away from the orphanage, but I don't feed pigeons.
He knocked on our door one night, and when I opened it, he was in his ragged bathrobe, holding a sheaf of papers and drunk. It was his will, and he wanted to read me part of it. No, he wouldn't have coffee, it killed him, but he'd have a beer.
So, you helped me out, and Alberta had me up for dinner. And no one ever has old guys up for dinner, so I'm leaving you $4,000, and Alberta $4,000, and I'm leaving you my Thomas Aquinas and my ties. Here's what it says in the will. To Frank McCourt, I leave my collection of ties, which he has admired, and which are anything but somber.
When we moved to Warren Street, we lost touch with Virgil for a while, though I wanted him to be godfather at Maggie's christening. Instead, there was a call from a lawyer telling me of Virgil Frank's death and the terms of his will as it pertained to us. However, said the lawyer, he changed his mind about the Summa Theologica and the tithes, so all you get is the money. Do you accept this?
Sure, yes.
But why did he change it?
He heard you went to Ireland for a visit and that upset him because you contributed to the gold flow.
What do you mean? According to Mr. Frank's will, President Johnson said a few years ago that Americans traveling abroad were draining the country of gold and weakening the economy, and that's why you're not getting the tithes that are anything but somber, and the 3 volumes of Aquinas. Okay?
Oh, sure.
Now that we had a portion of a down payment, we searched the neighborhood for a house. Our landlady, Hortensia O'Donnell, heard we'd been looking. And one day she climbed the outside fire escape at the back of the house and startled me when I saw her head at the kitchen window with the great curly wig.
Frankie, Frankie, open the window. It's cold out here. Let me in.
I reached out to help her in, but she yelled,
watch my hair, watch my hair.
And I had to do the heavy work of hauling her in the kitchen window while she hung on to her wig.
Whoo, she said. Whoo! Frankie, you got any rum?
No, Hortensia. Only wine or Irish whiskey.
Give me a whiskey, Frankie. My ass is frozen.
Here, Hortensia, tell me. Why don't you come up the stairs?
Because it's dark down there, that's why. And I can't afford to keep lights going night and day. And I can see the fire escape day and night.
Oh.
And what's this I hear? You and Alberta looking for a house? Why don't you buy this one?
How much?
$50,000.
$50,000?
That's right. Is that too much?
Oh, no. That's fine. The day we signed the agreement, we drank rum with her. While she told us how sad she was to leave this house, after all the years she was there, not with her husband Adonis, but her boyfriend Louis Weber, who was famous for running the numbers game in the neighborhood. And even though he was Puerto Rican, he was afraid of nobody, not even the Cosa Nostra, who tried to take over, till Louis walked into the Don's house, down in Carroll Gardens, and said, what is this shit? Excuse the language. And the Don admired Louis for his balls and told his goombas, back off. Don't bother Louis. And you know, Frankie, no one messes with the Italians in Carroll Gardens. You don't see no coloreds or PRs down there, no sir. And if you do,
they're passing through. The Mafia might have backed away from Louis, but Hortensia said you couldn't trust them. And any time she and Louis went for a drive, they rode with two guns between them, his and hers. And he told her if anyone came with trouble and put him out of commission, she was to take the steering wheel and yank it towards the sidewalk so that they'd hit a pedestrian instead of traffic. And the insurance company would take care of things, and if they didn't and gave Hortensia any trouble, he'd leave her with a set of phone numbers of a few guys, PRs. The goddamn Mafia wasn't the only game in town. And these guys would take care of the insurance companies, the greedy bastards. Excuse the language, Alberta. Is there any rum left, Frankie? Poor Louis, she said. The key fob or commission was bothering him, but he died in his bed. And I never go for a ride no more, but he left me a gun downstairs. You want to see my gun, Frankie? No? Well, I have it. And anyone comes into my apartment without an invitation gets it, Frankie, right between the eyes. Bang, boom, he's gone. Neighbors smiled and nodded and told us we had bought a gold mine. That everyone knew Louis had buried money in the basement of our new house, where Hortensia still lived, or over our heads in the false ceiling of the living room. All we had to do was pull down that ceiling, and we'd be up to our armpits in $100 bills. When Hortensia moved out, we dug up the basement to install a new waistline. No buried money. We pulled down false ceilings, exposed bricks and beams. We tapped on walls, and someone suggested we consult the psychic. We found an old doll with tufts of hair, no eyes, no arms, one leg. We kept it for our 2-year-old Maggie, who called it the Beast and loved it over all her other dolls. Hortensia moved to a small street-level apartment on Court Street and stayed there till she died or moved back to Puerto Rico. I often wished I'd spent more time with her and a bottle of rum, or that I'd introduced her to Virgil Frank so that we could have some rum and Irish whiskey and talk about Louis Weber and the gold flow and ways of reducing your telephone bills with an egg timer. Chapter 51. It's 1969, and I'm substitute teaching for Joe Curran, who's out for a few weeks with a drink. His students ask if I know Greek and seem disappointed that I don't. After all, Mr. Curran would sit at his desk and read or recite from memory long passages from the Odyssey, yeah, in Greek. And he'd remind his students daily he was a graduate of Boston Latin School and Boston College and tell them anyone who didn't know his Greek or Latin couldn't consider himself educated, could never lay claim to being a gentleman. Yes, yes, this might be Stuyvesant High School, he'd tell them, and you might be the brightest kids from here to the foothills of the Rockies, your heads stuffed with science and mathematics. But all you need in this life is your Homer, your Sophocles, your Plato, your Aristotle, your Aristophanes for the lighter moments, your Virgil for the dark places, your Horace to escape the mundane, and your Juvenal when you're completely pissed off with the world. The grandeur, boys, the grandeur that was Greece and the glory that was Rome. It wasn't the Greeks or the Romans his students loved. It was the 40 minutes when Joe droned or declaimed, and they could daydream, catch up on homework for other classes, doodle, nibble at sandwiches from home, carve their initials on desks that might have been occupied by James Cagney, Thelonious Monk, or certain Nobel laureates. Or they could dream of the 9 girls who'd just been admitted for the first time in the school's history. The 9 Vestal Virgins, Joe Curran called them, and there were complaints from parents that the suggestiveness of his language was inappropriate. Oh, inappropriate, my ass, said Joe. Why can't they speak simple English? Why can't they use a simple word like wrong? His students said, yeah, wasn't it something to see the girls in the hallway? 9 girls, nearly 3,000 boys, and what about the boys in the school? 50%, for Christ's sakes. Who didn't want the girls? What about that? They had to be dead from the waist down, didn't they? Then you'd wonder about Mr. Curran himself up there, shifting into English to talk about the Iliad and the friendship of Achilles and Patroclus. He couldn't stop talking about those two old Greeks and how Achilles was so furious with Hector for killing Patroclus, he killed Hector and dragged his body behind his chariot to show the power of his love for his dead friend, the love that dare not speak its name. But boys, oh boys, is there a sweeter moment in all of literature than that moment when Hector removed his helmet to calm the fears of his child? Oh, if only all our fathers removed their helmets. And when Joe blubbered into his gray handkerchief and used words like piss, you knew he'd left the school at lunch hour for a little tot around the corner at the gas house bar. There were days he returned so excited from thoughts that had come to him on the barstool. He wanted to thank God for leading him to teaching, so that he could forget the Greeks for a while to sing the praises of the great Alexander Pope and his ode on solitude. Happy the man whose wish and care a few paternal acres bound, content to breathe his native air in his own ground. And remember, boys and girls, is there a girl here? Raise your hand if you're a girl. No girls. Remember, boys, that Pope was indebted to Horace. Remember that. Will you promise on your mother's heads to remember that? If you remember Pope's debt to Horace, you'll know no one springs full-blown from his father's head. Will you remember? We will, Mr. Curran. What am I to tell Joe's students who complain that they have to read the Odyssey and all this old stuff? Who cares what happened in ancient Greece or Troy with men dying right and left over that stupid Helen? Who cares? Boys in the class say you wouldn't catch them fighting to the death over some girl that didn't want them. Yeah, they could understand Romeo and Juliet because a lot of families are dumb about you going up with someone from another religion. And they could understand West Side Story and the gangs, but they could never believe grown men would leave home the way Odysseus left Penelope and Telemachus and go off to fight over the stupid chick who didn't know enough to come inside. They had to admit Odysseus was cool the way he tried to dodge the draft, acting crazy and all. And they liked the way Achilles fooled him because Achilles is nowhere near as smart as Odysseus. But like, they can't believe he'd stay away 20 years fighting and fooling around and expect Penelope to like sit there spinning and weaving and telling the suitors get lost. Girls in the class say they can believe it, they really can. That women can be true forever because that's the way women are. And one girl tells the class what she read in a Byron poem, that man's love is of his life a thing apart, 'tis woman's whole existence. Boys hoot at this, but girls applaud and tell them what all the psychology books say, that boys their age are 3 years behind in mental development, though there are some in this class who must be at least 6 years behind, and they should therefore shut up. The boys try to be sarcastic, raising their eyebrows and telling each other, "Oh, la-dee-daw, smell me, I'm developed." But the girls look at each other, shrug, toss their hair, and ask me in a lofty tone if we could please get back to the lesson. Lesson? What are they talking about? What lesson? All I can remember is the usual high school whine about why we have to read this and why we have to read that, and my irritation, my unspoken response is that you have to read it, goddammit, because it's part of the curriculum. And because I'm telling you read it, I'm the teacher. And if you don't cut the whining and complaining, you'll get an English grade on your report card that will make zero look like a gift from the gods, because I'm standing here listening to you and looking at you, the privileged, the chosen, the pampered, with nothing to do but go to school, hang out, do a little studying, go to college, get into a money-making racket, grow into your fat 40s, still whining, still complaining, when there are millions around the world who'd offer fingers and toes to be in your seats, nicely clothed, well-fed,
with the world by the balls.
That's what I'd like to say, and never will. Because I might be accused of using inappropriate language, and that would give me a Joe Curran fit. No, I can't talk like that, because I have to find my way in this place. A far cry from McKee Vocational and Technical High School. In the spring of 1972, the English department chairman, Roger Goodman, offers me a permanent position at Stuyvesant High School. I'll have my own 5 classes and a building assignment where, once more, I'll keep order in the students' cafeteria and make sure no one drops ice cream wrappers or bits of hot dog on the floor, though boys and girls are allowed to sit together here and romance kills appetites. I'll have a small homeroom, the first 9 girls, seniors and ready to graduate. The girls are kind. They bring me things, coffee, bagels, newspapers. They're critical. They say I should do something about my hair, let the sideburns grow. This is 1972, and I should get with it, be cool, and do something about my clothes. I dress like an old man, and even though I have a few gray hairs, I don't have to look so old. They tell me I look uptight, and one of them kneads my neck and shoulders. Relax, she says. Relax. We're harmless. And they laugh the way women laugh when they share a secret, and you think it's about you. I'll have 5 classes a day, 5 days a week, where I have to memorize the names of 175 students, along with the names of a full homeroom class next year, another 35. And I'll have to be particularly careful with the Chinese and Korean students with their sarcastic, "That's okay if you don't know our names, Mr. McCourt. We all look the same." Or they might laugh, "Yeah, and all you white people look the same." I know all this from my days as a substitute teacher, but now I watch my students, my very own, stream into my room this first day of February 1972, Feast of St. Bridget. And I'm praying to you, Bridget, because these are kids I'll be seeing 5 days a week for 5 months. And I don't know if I'm up to it, Bridget. The times, they are a-changing. And you can see these Stuyvesant kids are worlds and years away from the ones I first met at McKee. We've had wars and assassinations since then. The 2 Kennedys, Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers. Boys at McKee wore short hair or pompadours greased back to a duck's ass. Girls had blouses and skirts, and their hair was permed to the stiffness of a helmet. Stuyvesant boys wear hair so long, people on the street sneer. You can hardly tell them from the girls, ha-ha. They wear tie-dye shirts, jeans and sandals, so that no one will ever guess they come from comfortable families all over New York. Stuyvesant girls let hair and breasts hang loose and drive the boys mad with desire, and cut their jeans at the knees for that cool poverty effect, because, like you know, they've had it with all that middle-class crap. Oh, yeah, they're cooler than the McKee kids because they've got it made. In 8 months, they'll be at colleges and universities all over the country. Yale, Stanford, MIT, Williams, Harvard, lords and ladies of the earth. And here in my classroom, they sit where they like, chatting, ignoring me, giving me their backs. One more teacher obstructing their way to graduation and the real world. Some stare as if to say, "Who is this guy?" They slump and slouch and gaze out the window or over my head. Now I have to get their attention. That's what I say. "Excuse me? May I have your attention?" A few stop talking and look at me. Others look offended at the interruption and turn away again. My 3 senior classes groan with the burden of the textbook they have to carry every day. An anthology of English literature. The juniors complain over the weight of their anthology of American literature. The books are sumptuous, richly illustrated, designed to challenge, motivate, illuminate, entertain. And they're expensive. I tell my students that carrying textbooks strengthens their upper bodies and hope the contents seep up to their minds. They glare at me. "Who is this guy?" There are teaching guides so detailed and comprehensive I need never think for myself. They're packed with enough quizzes, tests, examinations to keep my students in a constant state of nervous tension. There are hundreds of multiple-choice questions, true or false questions, fill in the blank spaces, match column A with column B, peremptory questions ordering the students to explain why Hamlet was mean to his mother, what Keats meant by negative capability, what Melville was getting at in his chapter on the whiteness of the whale. I'm ready, boys and girls, to march through the chapters from Hawthorne to Hemingway, from Beowulf to Virginia Woolf. Tonight you are to read the pages assigned, tomorrow we'll discuss. There may be a quiz. Then again, there may not be a quiz. Just don't gamble on it. Only the teacher knows for sure. On Tuesday, there will be a test. 3 Tuesdays from now, there will be an exam. A big exam. And yes, it will count. Your whole report card grade hinges on this exam. You also have tests on physics and calculus. Sorry for your troubles. This is English, the queen of the curriculum. And you don't know it, boys and girls, but I am armed with my teaching guides on American and English literature. I have them safe here in my bag. All the questions that will have you scratching your little heads, gnawing your pencils, dreading report card day, and I suppose hating me, because I'm the one who can thwart your Ivy League ambitions. I'm the one who skulked around the lobby of the Biltmore Hotel, cleaning up for your fathers and mothers. This is Stuyvesant, and isn't this the best high school in the city? Some say the best in the country. You asked for it. You could have gone to your neighborhood high schools where you'd be kings and queens, numero uno, top of your class. Here you're just one of the crowd scrambling for grades to bolster the precious average that would slip you into the Ivy League. It's your great God, isn't it? The average? Down in the Stuyvesant basement, they should construct a sanctum with an altar. They should mount on that altar a great red blinking neon 9. Blink, 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 the sacred initial digit you're desperate for in every grade, and you should pray and worship there. Oh, God, send me A's and 90s. Mr. McCourt, how come you only gave me a 93 on my report card? I was kind, but I did all the work handed in the papers you assigned. You were late with 2 papers, 2 points off for each one. But, Mr. McCourt, why 2 points? That's it, that's your grade. Oh, Mr. McCourt, how come you're so mean? It's all I have left. I followed the teacher guides. I launched the prefabricated questions at my classes. I hit them with surprise quizzes and tests and destroyed them with the ponderous detailed examinations concocted by college professors who assemble high school textbooks. My students resisted and cheated and disliked me. And I disliked them for disliking me. I learned the cheating game. Oh, the casual glance at the papers of students around you. Oh, the discreet little Morse code cough for your girlfriend and her sweet smile when she catches the multiple choice answer. If she's behind, you splay your fingers on the back of your head. 3 splays of 5 fingers would be question 15. A forefinger scratching the right temple is answer A, and other fingers represent other answers. The room is alive with coughs and body movements. And when I catch the cheaters, I hiss in their ears, they'd better cut it out, or their papers will be shredded into the waste paper basket, their lives ruined. I am lord of the classroom, a man who would never cheat, oh no, not if they flashed the answers in green letters on the bright side of the full moon. Every day I taught with my guts in a knot. A man lurking behind his desk at the front of the room, playing the teacher game with the chalk, the eraser, the red pen, the teacher guides, the power of the quiz, the test, the exam. I'll call your father. I'll call your mother. I'll report you to the governor. I'll damage your average so badly, kid. You'd be lucky to get into a community college in Mississippi. Weapons of menace and control. A senior, Jonathan, bangs his forehead on his desk and wails, Why do we have to suffer with this shit? We've been in school since kindergarten, 13 years, and why do we have to know what colour shoes Mrs. Dalloway was wearing at her goddamn party? And what are we supposed to make of Shakespeare troubling deaf heaven with his bootless cries? And what the hell is a bootless cry anyway, and when did heaven turn deaf? Around the room, rumbles of rebellion, and I'm paralyzed. They're saying, "Yeah, yeah," to Jonathan, who halts his head banging to ask, "Mr. McCourt, did you have this stuff in high school?" And there's another chorus of, "Yeah, yeah," and I don't know what to say. Should I tell them the truth, that I never set foot in a high school till I began teaching in one? Or should I feed them a lie about a rigorous secondary school education with the Christian Brothers in Limerick? I'm saved, or doomed, by another student who calls out, "Mr. McCourt, my cousin went to McKee on Staten Island, and she said you told them you never went to high school, and they said you were an okay teacher anyway, because you told stories and talked and never bothered them with all these tests." Smiles around the room. Teacher, unmasked. Teacher never even went to high school, and look what he's doing to us, driving us crazy with tests and quizzes. I'm branded forever with the label, teacher, who never went to high school. "So, Mr. McCourt, I thought you had to get a license to teach in the city." "You do." "Don't you have to get a college degree?" "You do." "Don't you have to graduate high school?" "You mean graduate from high school, from high school, from. "Yeah, yeah, okay. Don't you have to graduate from high school to get into college?" "I suppose you do." Tyra Lawyer, Grill's teacher, carries the day, and word spreads to my other classes. "Wow, Mr. McCourt, you never went to high school, and you're teaching at Stuyvesant? Cool, man." And into the trash basket I drop my teaching guides, my quizzes, tests, examinations, my teacher knows all mask. I'm naked and starting over, and I hardly know where to begin. In the 1960s and early 70s, students wore buttons and headbands demanding equal rights for women, blacks, Native Americans, and all oppressed minorities. An end to the war in Vietnam, the salvation of the rainforests and the planet in general. Blacks and curly-haired whites sprouted afros, and the dashiki and the tie-dye shirt became the garb of the day. College students boycotted class, taught in, rioted everywhere, dodged the draft, fled to Canada or Scandinavia. High school students came to school fresh from images of war and television news, men blown to bits in rice paddies, helicopters hovering, tentative soldiers of the Viet Cong blasted out of their tunnels, their hands behind their heads. Lucky for the moment they weren't blasted back in again. Images of anger back home. Marches. Demonstrations. "Hell no, we won't go." Sit-ins. Teach-ins. Students falling before the guns of the National Guard. Blacks recoiling from Bull Connor's dogs. "Burn, baby, burn. Black is beautiful. Trust no one over 30. I have a dream." And at the end of it all, your president is not a crook. On streets and in subways, I'd meet former students from McKee High School who would tell me of the boys who went to Vietnam, heroes when they left and now home in body bags. Bob Boger called me to tell me about the funeral of a boy who'd been in both our classes, but I didn't go because I knew that on Staten Island there would be pride in this blood sacrifice. The boys from Staten Island would fill more body bags than Stuyvesant could ever imagine. Mechanics and plumbers had to fight, while college students shook indignant fists, fornicated in the fields of Woodstock, and sat in. In my classroom, I wore no buttons, took no sides. There was enough ranting all around us, and for me, picking my way through five classes was minefield enough. "Mr. McCourt, why can't our classes be relevant?" "Relevant to what?" "Well, you know, look at the state of the world. Look what's happening."
There's always something happening. And we could sit in this classroom for 4 years, clocking over headlines and going out of our minds.
Mr. McCourt, don't you care about the babies burned with napalm in Vietnam?
I do. And I care about the babies in Korea and China, in Auschwitz and Armenia, and the babies impaled on the lances of Cromwell soldiers in Ireland. I told them what I'd learned from my part-time teaching at New York Technical College in Brooklyn, from my class of 23 women, most from the islands, and from my 5 men. There was a 55-year-old working for a college degree, so that he could return to Puerto Rico and spend the rest of his life helping children. There was a young Greek studying English, so that he could work towards a PhD in the literature of Renaissance England. There were 3 young African-American men in the class, and when one, Ray, complained he'd been bothered by the police on a subway platform because he was black, the women from the islands had no patience with him. They told him if he stayed home and studied, he wouldn't be getting into trouble, and no kid of theirs would come home with a story like that. They'd break his head. Ray was quiet. You don't talk back to women from the islands. Denise, now in her late 20s, was often late to class, and I threatened her with failure till she wrote an autobiographical essay, which I asked her to read to the class. Oh no, she couldn't do that. She'd be ashamed to let people know she had 2 children whose father had left her to return to Montserrat and never sent her a penny. No, she wouldn't mind if I read the essay to the class, if I didn't tell who wrote it. She had described a day in her life. She'd wake up early to do her Jane Fonda video exercises while thanking Jesus for the gift of another day. She'd take a shower, get her children up, her 8-year-old, her 6-year-old, and take them to school. And after that, she'd rush to her college classes. In the afternoon, she'd go straight to her job at a bank in downtown Brooklyn, and from there to her mother's house. Her mother had already picked up the children from school, and without her, Denise didn't know what she'd do, especially when her mother had that terrible disease that makes your fingers curl up in knots, and Denise didn't know how to spell. After taking the children home, putting them to bed, and getting their clothes ready for the next morning, Denise would pray by the side of her bed, look up at the cross, thank Jesus once more for another wonderful day, and try to fall asleep with his suffering image in her dreams. The women from the islands thought that was a wonderful story and looked at each other wondering who wrote it. And when Ray said he didn't believe in Jesus, they told him, shut up. What did he know hanging around subway platforms? They worked, took care of their families, went to school, and this was a wonderful country where you could do what you liked, even if you were black like the night. And if he didn't like it, he could go back to Africa, if he could ever find it without getting hassled by the police. I told the women they were heroes. I told the Puerto Rican man he was a hero. And I told Ray, if he ever grew up, he could be a hero too. They looked at me, puzzled. They didn't believe me. And you could guess what was running through their minds. That they were doing only what they were supposed to do, getting an education. And why was this teacher calling them heroes? My Stuyvesant students were not satisfied. Why was I telling them stories of women from the islands and Puerto Ricans and Greeks when the world was going to hell? Because the women from the islands believe in education, you can demonstrate and shake your fists, burn your draft cars and block the traffic with your bodies, but what do you know in the end? For the ladies from the islands, there is one relevance, education. That is all they know. That is all I know. That is all I need to know. Still, there was a confusion and a darkness in my head, and I had to understand what I was doing in this classroom or get out. If I had to stand before those 5 classes, I couldn't let days dribble by in the routine of high school grammar, spelling, vocabulary, digging for the deeper meaning in poetry, bits of literature doled out for the multiple choice test that would follow, so that universities can be supplied with the best and the brightest. I had to begin enjoying the act of teaching, and the only way I could do that was to start over, teach what I loved, and to hell with the curriculum. The year Maggie was born, I told Alberta something my mother used to say, that a child gains her vision at 6 weeks, and if that was true, we should take her to Ireland, so that her first image would be of moody Irish skies, a passing shower, with the sun shining through. Paddy and Mary Clancy invited us to stay on their farm in Carrick-on-Shore, but newspapers were saying Belfast was in flames, a nightmare city, and I was anxious to see my father. I travelled north with Paddy Clancy and Kevin Sullivan, and the night we arrived, walked the streets of Catholic Belfast. The women were out banging on the pavements with the lids of garbage cans, warning their men of approaching army patrols. They were suspicious of us till they recognized Paddy of the famous Clancy brothers, and we passed on without trouble. Next day, Paddy and Kevin stayed in the hotel, while I went to my uncle Gerard's house so that he could take me to my father in Andersonstown. When my father opened his door, he nodded at Uncle Gerard and looked through me. Uncle Gerard nodded toward me and said, "This is your son?" My father said, "Is it little Malachy?" "No, I'm your son, Frank." Uncle Gerard said, "It's a sad thing when your own father doesn't know you." My own father said, "Come in, sit down, will you have a cup of tea?" He offered the tea, but showed no signs of making it in his little kitchen, till a woman came from next door and did it. Uncle Gerard whispered, "See that? He never lifts a finger. He doesn't have to with the way the ladies of Andersonstown wait on him hand and foot. They tempt him daily with soup and dainty things." My father smoked his pipe, but never touched his mug of tea. He was busy asking about my mother and three brothers. "Ach, your brother Alfie came to see me? Quiet lad, your brother Alfie. Ach, aye, quiet lad. And you're all well in America? Attending to your religious duties? Ach, you have to be good to your mother and attend to your religious duties?" I wanted to laugh. Jesus, is this man preaching? I wanted to say, "Dad, have you no memory?" No, what's the use? I'd be better off leaving my father to his demons, though you could see from the peaceful way he had with his pipe and his mug of tea that the demons wouldn't cross his threshold. Uncle Gerard said we ought to leave before darkness fell on Belfast, and I wondered how I should say goodbye to my father. Shake his hand? Embrace him? I shook his hand because that's all we ever did, except for one time when I was in hospital with typhoid and he kissed my forehead. Now he drops my hand, reminds me once more to be a good boy, to obey my mother, and to attend to my religious duties. When we returned to his house, I told my uncle I'd like to walk through the Protestant area, the Shankill Road. He shook his head. "Quiet man." I said, "Why not?" "Because they'll know." "What will they know?" "They'll know you're a Catholic." "How will they know?" "Ach, they'll know." His wife agreed. She said, "They have ways." "Do you mean to say you could spot a Protestant if he walked down this street?" "We could." "How?" And my uncle smiled. "Ach, here's a practice." While we had another cup of tea, there was shooting down Leeson Street. A woman screamed, and when I went to the window, Uncle Gerard said, "Ach, get your head away from the window. One little movement and the soldiers are so nervous they'll spray it." The woman screamed again, and I had to open the door. She had a child in her arms and another one clinging to her skirt, and she was being forced back by a soldier pushing his slanted rifle. She begged him to let her cross Leeson Street to her other children. I thought I'd help by carrying the child clinging to her, but when I went to pick her up, the woman dashed around the soldier and across the street. The soldier swung on me and put his rifle barrel against my forehead. "Get inside, Paddy, or I'll blow your fucking head off." My uncle and his wife Lottie told me that was the foolish thing I did and it helped no one. They said that whether you were Catholic or Protestant, there was a way of handling things in Belfast that outsiders would never understand. Still, on my way back to the hotel in a Catholic taxi, I dreamed I could easily roam Belfast with an avenging flamethrower. I'd aim it at that bastard in his red beret and reduce him to cinders. I'd pay back the Brits for the 800 years of tyranny. Oh, by Jesus, I'd do my bit with a 50-caliber machine gun. I would indeed. And I was ready to sing Roddy McCauley Goes to Die in the Bridger Tomb Today, till I remembered that that was my father's song. And I decided instead I'd have a nice quiet pint with Paddy and Kevin in the bar of our Belfast hotel. And before I went to sleep that night, I'd call Alberta so that she could hold the phone to Maggie, and I'd carry my daughter's gurgle into my dreams. Mam flew over and stayed with us a while at our rented flat in Dublin. Alberta went shopping on Grafton Street, and Mam strolled with me to St. Stephen's Green with Maggie in her pram. We sat by the water and threw crumbs to ducks and sparrows. Mam said it was lovely to be in this place in Dublin in the latter end of August, the way you could feel autumn coming in with the odd leaf drifting before you and the light changing on the lake. We looked at children wrestling in the grass, and Mam said it would be lovely to stay here a few years and see Maggie grow up with an Irish accent. Not that she had anything against the American accent, but wasn't it a pure pleasure to listen to these children? And she could see Maggie growing and playing on this very grass. When I said it would be lovely, a shiver went through me, and she said someone was walking on my grave. We watched the children play and looked at the light on the water, and she said, "You don't want to go back, do you?" "Back where?" "New York." "How do you know that?" "I don't have to lift the lid to know what's in the pot." The porter at the Shelburne Hotel said it would be no bother at all to keep an eye on Maggie's pram against the railings outside, while we sat in the lounge, a sherry for Mam, a pint for me, a bottle of milk for Maggie on Mam's lap. Two women at the next table said Maggie was a dote, a right dote she was. Oh, gorgeous! And wasn't she the spitting image of Mam herself? "I know," said Mam, "I'm only the grandmother." The women were drinking sherry like my mother, but the three men were lowering pints, and you could see from their tweed caps, red faces and great red hands, they were farmers. One with a dark green cap called to my mother, "The little child might be a lovely child, Mrs., but you're not so bad yourself." Mam laughed and called back to him, "I sure you're not so bad either. Be God, Mrs., if you were a little older, I'd run away with you." "Well," said Mam, "if you were a little younger, I'd go." People all around the lounge were laughing, and Mam threw her head back and laughed herself, and you could see from the shine in her eyes she was having the time of her life. She laughed till Maggie whimpered, and Mam said the child had to be changed and we'd have to go. The man with the dark green cap put on a begging act. "Yarra, don't go, Mrs. Your future is with me. I'm a rich widow man with a farm of land." "Money isn't everything," said Mam. "But I have a tractor, Mrs. We could ride together, and how would that suit you?" "It stirs me," said Mam. "But I'm still a married woman, and when I put on the widow's weeds, you'll be the first to know." "Fair enough, Mrs. I live in the third house on the left, as you enter the southwest coast of Ireland, a grand place called Kerry." "I heard of it," said Mam. "'Tis known for sheep." "And powerful rams, Mrs., powerful." "You're never short of an answer, are you?" "Come to Kerry with me, Mrs., and we'll walk the hills wordless." Alberta was already at the flat making lamb stew, and when Kevin Sullivan dropped in with Ben Kiley, the writer, there was enough for everyone, and we drank wine and sang, because there isn't a song in the world Ben doesn't know. Mam told the story of our time in the Shelburne Hotel. "Lord above," she said, "that man had a way with him. And if it wasn't for Maggie needing to be changed and wiped, I'd be on my way to Kerry." When I put my head on the pillow that night, I knew there might be a morning suffering over the wine, but it would be worth it after a day in Dublin, where my mother read my mind, felt the step on my grave, and laughed off the offer of a tractor. In the 1970s, Mam was in her 60s. The emphysema that came from years of smoking left her so breathless she dreaded leaving her apartment anymore. And the more she stayed at home, the heavier she grew. For a while she came to Brooklyn to take care of Maggie on weekends, but that stopped when she could no longer climb the subway stairs. I accused her of not wanting to see her granddaughter.
I do want to see her, but 'tis hard for me to get around anymore.
Why don't you lose weight?
'Tis hard for an elderly woman to lose weight. And anyway, why should I?
Don't you want to have some kind of life where you're not sitting in your apartment all day looking out the window?
I had my life, didn't I? And what use was it? I just want to be left alone.
There were attacks which left her gasping. And when she visited Michael in San Francisco, he had to rush her to the hospital. We told her she was ruining our lives the way she always got sick on holidays, Christmas, New Year's Eve, Easter. She shrugged and laughed and said,
"Pity about you now."
No matter how her health was, no matter how breathless, she climbed the hill to the Broadway bingo hall till she fell one night and broke her hip. After the operation, she was sent to an upstate convalescent home, and then stayed with me at a summer bungalow in Breezy Point at the tip of the Rockaway Peninsula. Every morning she slept late, and when she woke, sat slumped on the side of her bed, staring out the window at a wall. After a while, she'd drag herself into the kitchen for breakfast, and when I barked at her for eating too much bread and butter that she'd be the size of a house, she barked back at me, "For the love of Jesus, leave me alone. The bread and butter is the only comfort I have." In the city, I would take her to the Lion's Head for a hamburger and a highball, her favorite drink. She would chat at the bar with Paddy Clancy, Joe Flaherty, Ernie Newcanon. Everyone said she was a charming, funny character, and that shows you have to discover your mother through other people. Sheila McKenna and Joanne O'Donnell told her one night, "Mrs. McCourt, you must be so proud of your four fine sons."
"Proud, is it? Proud? Every one of them is a Gethsemane to me."
Ernie Newcanon had a female friend, a pocket-sized Welsh philosopher with a PhD, who trotted the length of the bar trying to draw customers into deep discussions on life and the meaning of it all. They shooed her away. "Go away. Get lost, small Welsh philosopher," till her instincts led her to Mam, benign at the bar with her highball.
"Madam, do you realize all things have life and soul, all things animate and inanimate? Do you realize, madam, that even green plants have life?"
"I don't know anything about that," said Mam. "I live alone."
She liked her highball and her drop of sherry, and functions where there was dancing. This was the girl known all over Limerick for her dancing and her way with a song. But now she was heavier, and when I tried to whirl her on the dance floor, she'd gasp,
"Oh God, don't wheel me, don't wheel me."
Till one night at an Irish event, she tried a few steps and gave up.
"I think me dancing days are done," she said.
"They're not. They are.